After 32 years, I came out of the closet as a gay Christian pastor. Finally, on the outside of that suffocating prison, I'm looking around and I'm like, we can't stay here. It's not enough to become informed. We have to do something about the harm we're still witnessing within systems and spaces we've been loyal to for so long. It's time we become reformers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Reformer. I'm your host, Mike Maestro, and I've got a guest I'm going to be interviewing today. I want to give you some background because it didn't really come up in the episode like we probably needed. I don't know how many of you were 90s kids like I was, but Christian music was, you know, quite the thing when you're raised in an evangelical home. And so the CCM world was kind of burgeoning at that time. And there was a band at that time period, early 90s, early 2000s, the 90s to the 2000s, called Cademan's Call. Many of you would recognize their stuff. Like, for example, one of the songs that, you know, I knew and loved of theirs was God of Wonders, right? God of Wonders beyond our galaxy. That's Cademan's Call. They wrote that and, you know, put it out. Anyway, Derek Webb is coming on to the podcast today in this episode, and he was a singer songwriter for them for 10 years, like a big part of that group. And he went on a journey, and like several Christian artists who have since like had to leave the industry because their beliefs and convictions had changed, Derek was one of the earlier like people in that world who did that publicly. And I'm so excited to interview him. I can't wait for you to hear his story. I so respect this man and the journey he's been on and the choices he continues to make. Just like brave, you know, an advocate, an ally, someone who just truly like aligns with their beliefs and convictions and is so eloquent and deep. And you know, sadly, we're not going to get into everything that Derek has to bring to the table like we could with anyone, but Derek has so much depth and history and experience, and he's such a thoughtful person. And so this episode is going to be like an appetizer of who Derek is and what's happening in his world, but I can't wait to introduce you to him and share his story with you. Let's go. Derek, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm so happy to be talking to you. I think about you all the time, and I follow you obviously online and everywhere else, and I see all the great stuff that you're doing, and I'm such a fan of yours, and you're right. We have not gotten enough time to hang out. So I'm just so pleased to be seeing you and to be talking to you.
Thank you. Likewise. Yeah, totally.
Regardless if we were recording this or doing anything else, I'm just happy.
Totally. I mean, every time we talk, it's always like, oh God, I need to talk to this person more every time. So anyway, we're doing this. For those of you who don't know, Derek was a part of a band called Cademan's Call, which was in the Christian music world, huge in the 90s, early 2000s. Derek, can you give us an intro into just your world there real quick, just to give people that context?
Yes, absolutely. So it was early 90s. I was just out of high school, and a high school friend of mine introduced me to this guy, Cliff Young. This is all in Houston, Texas. And that's where I went to school. That's where I went to high school. And Aaron Tate is my high school friend who introduced me to Cliff. I did not know that Aaron was an unbelievable songwriter, like a savant songwriter. I did not know that in our high school relationship we'd had. I just didn't know that he wrote songs. He and Cliff went to college together at TCU, Texas Christian University, in Fort Worth. And Cliff met Aaron, heard his songs just like you do in college, like everybody's sitting around with guitars. And I guess he heard these songs and realized that Aaron had written them. And he's like, hey, these are great songs. Do you do anything with this? Like, are you, you know, and Aaron didn't, and actually was not interested in doing anything like a band, or he did not want to do anything. He just loved writing. And so when Cliff figured all this out, he was like, well, listen, like these songs are unbelievable and I would love to play them. Could I start a band and play your songs? Like, would you be cool with that? And Aaron said, yeah, absolutely. And then Cliff immediately needed a band. And so he, I think in the same conversation, the same day with Aaron, said, well, can you introduce me to any musicians? Cause I need, now I need a band to play your songs. And Aaron introduced Cliff to me because Aaron and I had been friends in high school. Aaron knew I was into like Indigo Girls and like folk rock music. And that's kind of what the style was. He knew I loved that. So he introduced me to Cliff. Cliff and I met up in Houston and he showed me Aaron's songs. It was so strange because this is my friend, like I've known for years, yeah, and I'm hearing his songs out of this other person. And Cliff and I hit it off. I lost my mind over these songs that Cliff was showing me of Aaron's. And basically that was it. I mean, right then and there, I mean, I had been in bands my whole life. I've been a musician. I've played guitar, you know, and stuff since I was single digits, since I was 6, 7 years old. I've always done it. I was in bands my whole life, mostly like rock cover bands and stuff all through high school and middle school and stuff. But like, so I've always done it. But when I met Cliff and when I heard Aaron's songs right at that juncture, it was like, that's what I had been looking for. Like it was probably the first time. I loved all the bands I was in high school and all those bands. Like we won Battle of the Bands a bunch of years. Like they weren't not good bands, but this was the first time that there was music that I really loved and would listen to that we were making. Like I heard Aaron's songs coming out of Cliff and I was like I would buy this record. Like I love these songs. It sounds like what I listened to. Like it was so good. And so I was really excited about that. And I just canceled my whole life to join this band. I had plans, you know, I mean, I wasn't really going to go to college or anything, but my parents thought I was. And so, and, you know, but I, whatever plans I had, I just canceled all of it to follow these songs, this energy, these people, and just immediately got caught up in this really great community of people that Cliff and his friends and he was such a magnetic character. He's still one of my great friends and we're super different, but he was a real visionary. And I wasn't so much at that point in my life, in my kind of early 20s, like late teens, early 20s. I wasn't. I had not figured a lot about myself out yet. But Cliff was like an opportunist and he was well-resourced and his dad was the pastor of this giant church in Houston. And there were all these resources and he just knew all these people and he had this great personality. He was a genuinely really good guy and I just loved him. And so I just kind of fell in with him and his friends, which wound up being my friends. And then the band members just kind of came in one after the other over the period of just a few months. And so the band just started right there, like in 92, right at that moment. And that was it. I mean, it's like, so it was the early 90s there. It was before, you know, the music space changed the way that it eventually did. It was still kind of old school where you're kind of looking to get a record deal and you're looking to, you know, it was before, you know, the big disruption, and all that happened. But it was like, we just had, and I, at the times that I've told this story more recently, I've realized, the Cadmans and I did something together in just the last couple of years. We had a record that went out of print. That was our first major label record. It was self-titled and it had gone out of print and it turned 25 a couple of years ago, big 25th anniversary, but it was out of print. So we couldn't celebrate. So we decided to re-record it and put it back out, which we just did. And so I've been talking about Cadmans more recently and I love these people. We've done work together in the last couple of years, but like, as I told the story, I realized it's almost like Malcolm Gladwell. Almost like it's like an outlier situation because there were all these circumstances around that Cadmans thing that happened that just made that work. And if anybody's familiar with like Gladwell and especially the Outliers, he tells the story of like all these unlikely things that happened that circumstantially just everything was just set up for it to work. And he talks about the Beatles and he talks about how like there were a lot of bands in Liverpool doing exactly what the Beatles were doing, but why did the Beatles go on to become the biggest band of all time? Where there were all these circumstantial things that just fell into place for them. And I felt like for us, it was just the same thing. Like all these circumstantial things fell into place. Like Cliff's dad was a pastor of this giant church. They had a recording studio in their church. That was way before anybody could afford to own recording stuff. Like before you could have a recording studio on your laptop or on your phone, for God's sake, like you can now. It was really hard and expensive to record music. It was really hard to distribute music. It was hard to get gigs. but we were college age. We lived in Texas. There's like 1,000 colleges in Texas to tour in. And all of our friends were at those colleges so they could get us gigs. It was one thing after the other just led to our succeeding. And we did. And so within a few, we put out a couple indie records. Within a few years, got a record deal. And we put out 3 or 4 records over about 10 years. And so I was in that band until the early 2000s. And it was around that time that I, it had been 10 years. And you know, I was kind of started to, I was, in terms of my songwriting, I started writing for the band within the first couple of years and then wound up writing about half the band's material. So I was one of the 2 songwriters. And after those 10 years, I just kind of was needing to explore some riskier territory in my songwriting, and it wasn't something I wanted to put on the band. And so I decided, okay, I started to write songs. I started to kind of give into it and go ahead and write some of these riskier songs for me. And I was showing them to the band, and they thought the songs were great, but were rightfully resistant. They were like, I don't see how we can play these songs, though. Like, I just don't see how we can do it. I mean, it's such a huge risk, and it could really get us in a lot of trouble. And, you know, and for a younger band, it would have been different, because I feel like we were risky earlier on, which tends to be the case. Younger bands are way more risk tolerant because they've got nothing to lose. But 10 years in, you know, I get it. And so we talked about it, and I said, listen, I can't do Cademans and do this and do both very well. So I have to make a choice. And I really right now feel like I need to follow this energy now. This feels important. These songs feel important. The first few songs I'd written songs like Wedding Dress. You know, that was kind of an early song for me in my solo career that was like a real kind of a touch point for me. Like that early on was like a really provocative song or whatever for me. But I wrote it as a Cademan song. And I kind of followed that right out and into a solo career. And they totally understood, but that's what launched me into whatever I'm doing now and have been doing since, you know, for more than 20 years, I've been a solo artist, so.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, amazing. I have several questions.
Okay.
Well, okay, my first question is, I'm gonna write some of my other questions down. My first question is, what were some of the things you were seeing that you were like, this is hitting me on a moral, ethical level. I got to say something. What were you seeing? What were you experiencing?
Well, so the main thing at that time, I can be very specific about it, because there was like literally a moment, like a pivot for me. And so our band was at this big, when you're doing this kind of work, especially back then in the big kind of Christian retail or whatever, you would have to go to these things, these big conferences, these big retail conferences. So there was this one that's called CBA, the Christian Booksellers Association, but it wasn't just for authors, it was for everybody. And it was like a weekend thing with a convention floor and showcases. And you basically go there and you kind of bring whatever your new thing is that you're going to be selling this year. And all the, people who represent all the Christian retail in America are there. The people who literally decide what goes on the shelves and what gets priority and what goes on the end caps and what gets marketed more heavily. And all the bands and authors and everybody are there trying to kind of promote themselves and hoping to get some priority with all these Christian retailers. So, and that's just a thing you have to do. So we were doing it this one year, and we had a really amazing like opening night headlining spot. But you're there with other bands and authors and all these people, and it's like everybody's opening for everybody. And so we were like the headliner at the end of the night because we had a big record that was about to come out that year. And right before us, they had put the guy who'd had the big year on the writing side, and it was a guy named Bruce Wilkinson. And Bruce had written a book called The Prayer of Jabez. And The Prayer of Jabez was this like little tiny little book, little hardback, little tiny book, that on the back of it said, the prayer of Jabez is the prayer that God has to answer. And he had taken a very obscure Old Testament character, very obscure Old Testament moment and prayer, a guy we don't know hardly anything about. We don't know exactly what he asked for. We don't know exactly how God answered him. It's very abstract. It's like there's no details. And it's just this random thing he plucked out. And he basically turned it into a little formulaic thing that you could do. And his thing was, if you pray this prayer every single day for 30 days, God must answer you. And it was a prayer must. And it was a prayer about at your territory being expanded. It was kind of like a wealth and expansion, you know, kind of, which is very popular amongst a lot of big megachurch pastors. It's like God's going to make you rich. If you pray the prayer Jabez every single day for 30 days, God's going to give you, he's going to expand your territory, which basically means he's going to give you money and wealth and whatever you want. And it doesn't matter what your relationship is to Jesus, what your relationship is to anything. All you have to do is have this book and you have to pray this prayer, these words every single day, 30 days, God must do it. And his book was already millions over bestseller at that time. He was going right before us. And so I walked in there ready to, with an open mind, to hear Bruce talk about the prayer of Jabez and to be like, you know, I don't know, maybe it's okay. And I couldn't believe, he got up there and said all this stuff. And I just couldn't believe what was, the main thing I couldn't believe was when at the end of all this stuff he said that made no sense to me, he invited all of the people who stock all of the Christian retail stores in America. He said, do you want to, I'm gonna give you a Jabez challenge. And do you want your stores, if you will come up right now, it was like a Billy Graham crusade. If you want to come up to the front right now and commit to praying this prayer every day for 30 days, when I see you at this conference next year, God is going to have expanded. Your retail stores are going to be bigger. Your sales are going to be bigger. You're going to be moving into the store next door because God's going to expand your territory. And if you pray the prayer every day for 30 days. And I was like, surely these people surely know what's in the Bible. And they know that this is not, that's not what that remotely is supposed to, that's not what that, what the prayer of, you know, Jabez and the whole thing, that's not what's going on there. Surely they're going to see through this. And I swear to God, the whole place just crying, and they were just got up and they just packed up to the front, arms around each other. There was 200 people at the front of the stage, and he prayed over them that they would be faithful in praying the prayer every day for 30 days. And he can't wait to see that how God's going to expand their territory. And I saw this, and I almost couldn't do the set. I mean, we had to play right after. So we got up and I said something. The label was very nervous, but I said something to distance us from him. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but I made some comment. And then that night went back to my hotel room and wrote the song Wedding Dress, which was not only about Bruce Wilkinson and the prayer of Jabez. It's also about me. I mean, I eventually realized, no, this is about me. This is about how I want, you know, my ears are so easily tickled by the promises of people who do not speak for the Bible or Jesus or anything, whatever. And so, yeah, I mean, so for me, it was like watching the way that the Christian space sold safety and security and certainty, and people just bought it up. And none of that is in the Bible. None of that is in any version of Christianity I'd ever experienced. And so that was the initial thing. It was such a big deal. And so as I was seeing not just that, but all this other stuff, it was just like, bro, like these people walk into these Christian bookstores. I mean, my air quotes again, these Christian bookstores, and these stores are basically saying, come in and just check your discernment at the door, because everything here has been pre-vetted for your spiritual benefit and nourishment. Everything here is right, true, good, beautiful. It's Christian, quote. So just come in and consume at will. Your children can come in and consume at will. This is all right, true, good, and beautiful, redeemed. This is the music and the breath mints and the books and that we're going to have in heaven. This is all the redeemed stuff. So come in. They're selling this security and safety and certainty, and once it hit me, I was like, I have to be a bull in a china shop in this. Like, I have to risk it. I mean, even though that's where people are going to go to buy my solo records, I have to try and destroy it. I mean, it's like, I hated it. That's what I started writing about. I started writing about the ways that I saw Western cultural Christianity selling things that had nothing to do with my understanding of Orthodox Christianity. Things like certainty and safety and security. And so, yeah, I really bristled, and that's what took me into it. Now, in just the years just after, I started going after, for instance, the way that the American church equated holiness with nationalism, the way that being a Christian meant voting straight ticket Republican. And I went after that. I got very political after just a couple of records. I went very far into that deal. I made at least three records about not just politics, but also the idea of war and having a consistent ethic of human life. So it got very social and very political over a handful of records. And then right after that, it was about the church's treatment of the gay community. And that was early on. That was in 2009, maybe. Stockholm Syndrome was the record that I started talking about that. So it's like everywhere I could see the church being very inconsistent with the person that I understood Jesus to be at that time, I was writing.
Wow.
And that became kind of my ethic. That became like the thing that I, that's what I did. That's what I do.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Amazing. So obviously you had like an audience, right? People who like knew you, recognized you, appreciated you, trusted you. How did they respond to this like rebranding, if you will?
Right. Well, it's been rough. It's been rough over the years, you know, because it's like I did come out of Cademan's into my solo career with so much. Again, Malcolm Gladwellian, again, it's because like I had a very unlikely solo career because I came out, I started my solo career with the benefit of 10 years in this band that had done really well and had a lot of fans, and a lot of them followed me into my solo career. And so they trusted me. You're right. I mean, it's like I kind of went into it with those benefits. And so it was a very, like my debut solo record, it was called She Must and Shall Go Free. It didn't get carried in a ton of Christian retail. They wouldn't carry it because of language and content. They put it behind the shelves or they wouldn't carry it at all. And so it was like I was fighting from the get-go. But I felt really strongly about the work I was doing. I found people who I was working with on the label side, for instance, who felt strongly about supporting me and the work I was doing. And then over the years, it was just like, as long as I was being equal opportunity, like with my big mouth, and I was like not trying to pick and choose, I was just looking for like where, I just followed it wherever it led. It wasn't even about things that I, at whatever time, felt especially opinionated about. It was just like where, because I remember like during, so it would have been records like Mockingbird and The Ringing Bell. Those were my kind of more political records and the ones that started getting more into war and ethics and that sort of thing. Those weren't even topics that were really huge on my radar until I started seeing the way the church was kind of co-opting people into voting a certain way and into certain political parties, and how that the church had been co-opted by politicians and parties, and the way they would manipulate Christians with their language. And God knows here in 2024, we're seeing, you know, Trump just came out with the God Bless the USA Bible, for God's sake, trying to, you know, pay off all the money he owes to women that he's assaulted. And so anyways, it's like, you know, but it was even way back then, I was seeing it. And so I was like, okay, I need to write about it. But I had to educate myself because I didn't really know a ton about some of that stuff. So I really followed it. I followed those coordinates around. And as I did, yeah, people fell off. For sure, people did. And eventually with my solo career, I decided, you know what? I don't need as many fans as Cademan's Call had. And I will never have that many fans. And it's not what I'm doing. It's a super different thing that I'm doing. Because I am trying actively to disrupt. Like that's actually the main thing I'm trying to do. Jeff Mosley, who is a great friend of mine, and he was the guy whose record label I was on for 10 years of my solo career. He said to me once that the way he saw me was my job or whatever, and I liked this language and he gifted it to me, was, you know, he borrowed it from somewhere, but is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Like that was my job. That was kind of, and that resonated with me. And I was like, yeah, that sounds about, you know, right. And so as a result though, yeah, it's hard to keep fans. It's like, I do this for a living too. So I'm trying to get people to pay me to do it. And if I'm gnawing on their hands as they're giving me the money, it's really hard. And so, you know, I've had to get smart about how I run my career and how I make it work, and lean really into the people who seem to resonate the most with it and really love on those people and really lock arms with those people, you know? And
so when you left the Christian music world,
yeah,
and you've been out of it for a couple decades now, has there been a point in your journey where you were like, was that the wrong move? Should I not have done that? You know, was there ever any kind of like regret around that decision?
Yeah. I'll tell you what, like, I have never regretted trusting my gut creatively. So I can tell you that. Like, I really, for whatever reason, I have always had a very strong gut in terms of what is the right next thing for me to do. Like, what do I need to do next? And I've never really regretted following those coordinates and trusting my gut. And now, there are times when I have for sure thought to myself how much easier my life and my career would be if I was willing to make some small compromises here and there. Like, I know how to sell more records. I could definitely be more successful than I am. I just like the sleep that I get. I'm not willing to give up. I'm not willing to give up my night's sleep. Wow. Because I know how to do it. Like, I know how to, like, I've been a songwriter for 30 years. I know how to, for instance, I know how to write worship songs. I absolutely know how to write worship songs. Very benign, but very singable and emotionally triggering, emotionally manipulative worship songs. I know exactly how to make you put your hands in the air, make you stand up from your seat. I know how to do it. Like, it's not, and the thing is, so do a ton. I mean, I'm literally like looking out my window. You know, my wife and our family, we live in, you know, kind of on the south side of Nashville. I've got a ton of friends who live right around here who are professional songwriters, and they make a ton of money writing songs in the worship space. And some of them aren't even Christians, but it's a language you can learn. It's like writing country music. You don't have to have grown up on a farm to write country music. It's just a language. It's a vernacular. You learn it. You learn how to speak it. It's just like being bilingual. And then you just write songs for people who like that kind of music, even though you might not remotely relate to or be anything like them. It's exactly the same in Christian music. Wow. And so it's like, I know how to do it. I could line up appointments all week with friends writing songs like that. I just don't want to do it. Like, I just think that would be awful and manipulative. And I don't, not for everyone it isn't, but for me, it would be a compromise. Mm. And so, yeah, there are times when I'm like, man, like, just a little compromise. Can I just make a little compromise and make like a little more money? Like, it's like, I like the struggle. It keeps me honest, but man, come on, you know? So, yeah. So
totally.
Yeah.
Okay. So you made a move. I think it was last year. Flamey Grant, you did this, I mean, controversial, right? Like, I don't imagine this is the only controversial thing you did, but you did a music video with a drag queen and you got dressed up in drag as you were performing. It's a really cool video. It's a powerful song. Can you tell me, like, why did you do that?
Flamey Grant is a musician, a singer-songwriter, a drag performer I've known for years and years and who I love, and I'm a huge fan of, and we're very good friends. And last year we had both duetted on each other's records. So Flamey came out with a record last year that was called Bible Belt Baby. It was her first full-length album. And I came out with a record called The Jesus Hypothesis, and that's my newest record. And so I had sang a duet on one of Flamey's songs, a song called Good Day. And then Flamey had sang on one of my songs, and it was a song called Boys Will Be Girls. And Boys Will Be Girls is a song I wrote for somebody who I'm very close to, who I love, who came out to me just a few years ago. And I think I was one of the first people they told that to. And I was so moved by their trust and their vulnerability that I basically, the way I responded to them in that moment is what's in this song. That song was basically my response to that person who I love, who told me that, and who shared that with me. And I just thought they'll need to hear this more than once. So I wrote it into a song they could bring with them. And so I wrote that song, and Flamey sang a duet on it with me. But we were talking about the song, and Flamey, I'm pretty sure it was Flamey's idea. She said, you know what would be kind of amazing is considering, you know, what the song says, sometimes boys will be girls. And it's both about gender. It is a song for trans people, but it's also just, it's not only, it's not, I wouldn't say that I think it's probably very resonant with anyone who has had to have a coming out conversation with anybody, which I think are, you know, it's strange that we have to have these conversations, that there's some presumption in our culture where the coming out conversations have to be from the queer people. Like why don't the straight people have to have the coming out conversation too? Like, okay, well, here's who I am and here's who I am and here's how I see people and here's how I see myself, but we don't. And that's stupid. But anyway, so Flamey and I were talking about that song, and Flamey said, you know, what would be kind of amazing is, what if you made a video for the song literally where a boy becomes a girl by the end of the video? And I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, well, what if you come to San Diego? At that time, Flamey lived in San Diego. Come to San Diego, and what if I put you in drag over the course of the video? So you start as a boy, and by the end, you're a girl. And I just was like, are you kidding? I mean, it sounds like it's the best idea I've ever heard. I couldn't believe. And what a gift, you know, that someone like Flamey would be willing to facilitate this experience, like would be willing to do this with and for me. And so, I couldn't resist. And we got talking about it. And so I did. I went up to San Diego and we got in this church, and we wanted to do it in a church. Because there's a great community there. This one church is where Flamey had gone to church at that time, and beautiful, affirming, radically welcoming community there. And they let us shoot the whole thing in their sanctuary, in their chapel. And so here I am at a church, Flamey, I'm looking right at the camera. And over the course, I'm singing this song, and over the course of the video, I'm slowly but surely just being made up. And by the end, I'm a drag queen. I'm a queen. And Flamey's in it at the end with me, and we're singing together. And it's just like, it was one of the sweetest, most meaningful things that's probably ever happened in my career. And all my professional work, it was really something. It was really, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. Happened. Yes.
Yeah.
So when that video came out, it predictably was disruptive. It shook, you know, it kind of rattled some folks, and that's what it was meant to do. I mean, I loved it because it put a real bullseye on that song and that subject matter. And I wanted that to be emphasized. I did not want that to go unnoticed. And so I loved that happened. And, Flame, I don't know how far you want to go into these stories, but like Flamey and I have continued to do work together and get into trouble together over the last couple of years. So anyways.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would love to hear more stories, but I also do want, just given the time we have, I want to hear what was the process like of, I don't know if it's deconverting, if that's the right term, or deconstructing, or no longer identifying as an evangelical, because it sounds like you started in that world, right? Like, could you speak to that?
Yeah. Yep. And so that's like, I have to say something I did not see coming. I know a lot of people have told me that based on my early records, I think just because I was critical of the church, and I think that people saw that as early signs of deconstruction, which I did not see at all. Why would I be critical if I didn't deeply care? Like the reason, there was a song on my first record, She Must Shall Go Free, that was a song called The Church. And the line of it was sung from the perspective of Jesus. And the chorus of it is, if you love me, then you'll love the church. Because at that time, I was seeing a lot of people saying, just me and Jesus, and that's all I need. And I don't need all that. I don't have to go to church and be a part of that whole thing. And that's messy, and I don't want to do it. And at the time, I had a very strong belief that if you're going to be involved in this, and if you're going to be someone who follows Jesus, like he did put a high priority on being part of a community, doing this in community. This is not a solo sport. This is a thing you do with people, and you're together with people as the hands and feet of Jesus in the world, kind of thing. I mean, that was the language I remember using at the time. And so I was writing all those songs because I cared really deeply about the church and about that whole scene. So I did not see all that stuff as early signs of deconstruction, but over time, here's what I'll say. This will distill it. And I've used this metaphor before, but it's helpful for me, that it's impossible to determine the safety of the boat you're in while you're in it. It's impossible to determine if the boat you're in can hold you while you're in it, because you are so highly incentivized to believe that it can. Because if it can't, then suddenly you're terrified because your life's at stake. If the boat you're in can't hold you, can't protect you from the waves, can't save you. And so sometimes it takes being thrown out of that boat in order to get a good look at it. And so that's essentially what happened. So like maybe 10 years ago, I went through a hard personal season. I went through a divorce. And it was a rough time. And around that time, it just kind of called me for all my chips. It was such a big wave that I hit that it tossed me out of that boat. And so I was able to get a look at it, and I was able to say, can this hold me? Now that I've been practicing Christianity for all this time, now it's showtime. Now it's like, we're going to really see if it really deeply comforts me. And if it really, now that I'm not just hypothetically talking about what it's supposed to do, now I'm going to lean on this community. I'm going to lean on these truths. I'm going to lean on this God who is both good and powerful and made all things. I'm going to lean on all this. Can it bear my weight? And I just found for me that it could not. I did not find it necessary. I did not find it compelling. I did not find it comforting. Not the people, not the institution, not the idea of God, at least the God that I had understood in my 30-something years of evangelical Christian belief. And I'm willing to take some responsibility for that and say maybe the God I was believing was just all the things I got wrong about God and Christianity. Maybe it was something I made up. I'm open to accepting that if that's the case. But on my newest record, The Jesus Hypothesis, I did write a song that sums this up. And it's a song that's called Some Gods Deserve Atheists. And all I can tell you is the evangelical God of my last 30 years that I did not find necessary, comforting, or compelling deserved an atheist out of me. Now, I'm not saying that's the end-all real God of the universe. I'm just saying God as I understood it, them, he, them, whatever it is, was not compelling to me. And so I detached. I mean, I just basically had to admit, like, I am not. And it wasn't even that. It wasn't even like an active detachment. It was just like a acknowledging what I was actually believing. It was the difference. It was the way that my hypothetical beliefs and my actual beliefs had gotten out of alignment. So the thing that I was saying I was believing, my practical beliefs were very different. So I was saying yes, Jesus and God and heaven and this and that, but my practical beliefs over time just kind of got out of harmony. They got incongruent with that. And I realized, you know what? That's actually not, if you look at my behavior, you will see what I am believing. You will see what I am assuming is true and what I am, you'll see it if you look at my behavior. And I have to admit, it's not a belief in the God of the Bible anymore. It just isn't. That clearly is not what I'm believing. So I just have to get caught up and bring that back into alignment again and say, I'm going to start saying out loud what I'm actually believing, not what I say that I'm believing, but what I'm actually believing. And so really it was like, it wasn't all at once, but it was really just me catching my language up with what I had been practicing over a period of years. Yeah. And eventually I just realized, you know what? None of this seems, I don't know. I just don't find it believable or necessary or compelling anymore. I just don't. And sometimes it takes that, again, to sum it up, that moment where you're having to lean your weight on it and you realize it can't bear it, or maybe it's just not necessary. Maybe you don't need a boat. Maybe there's nothing wrong with the water. Maybe it's like, you know, you don't need something between you and the waters of reality. Maybe that's, you know, maybe that's the problem, is I was so convinced, or someone had convinced me I needed a boat. And once I was thrown from it, I was like, oh, like the water's fine. Like what, why the boat? What was that about? I've spent my last 30 years in the constraints and confines of this little world that I had and others had created around me. And all of it was not maybe real or necessary. And it was good for controlling my behavior as an adolescent, maybe, but it's no way for an adult to live. An adult with a body and a conscience and an inner voice that I don't need the threat of eternal damnation to know what's right and wrong and how to treat people with kindness and respect. And, you know, and so, and I've said this too, but there's a point at which when you realize that somehow you've gotten more tolerant and radically welcoming and loving than the loving God of the universe. Because here I was saying, I don't have any problem with what you're saying and your lifestyle and your gender and your sexuality. I don't have any problem with any of it. What am I supposed to do? I mean, here's the Bible over here says this. Apparently your God seems to think this. And so I'm so sorry, but I'm cool with it. It's like, at what point when I'm apologizing for the loving God of the universe, because I've apparently become more loving, do you have to start questioning whether or not that God makes sense?
Right.
And so it was all that combined. And I just was like, oh, well, yeah, I think it's, I have to be honest about it. And so the language caught up and there we were.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. Oh, I have like 20 questions I want to ask you, but.
Part two, we'll do it.
Perhaps we have to do that. I love it. Derek, amazing. I'm going to record a brief intro to just put a little bit more on the front end of this conversation. With everything you're doing now, what's the best way for people to engage with your work and participate in what you're doing?
Yeah, thank you. So yeah. I'm real easy to find on the internet. So I'm just everywhere you go looking, I'm, you know, at Derek Webb, DerekWebb. So DerekWebb.com is probably the best spot. I know nobody goes to websites anymore, but that is a great spot to go to just figure out everything that's going on and get sent everywhere else you want to go. Okay. DerekWebb.com. But any, all social media, I'm just at Derek Webb. And, you know, I've got, I do have a community, a Patreon community that where we really are close and we really, you know, dig in together and we meet regularly on Zoom and I do exclusive, like a ton of exclusive stuff for those people. That's really where the work's happening. And that's like the tip of the spear of my creativity is happening for that community.
Okay.